DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet. From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. It's good to be back with you. And coming up on the show today, how Senegalese are bringing the octopus back from the brink. Adapting to change, Easter Islanders embrace sustainable fishing practices. And we meet the Indian volunteer who's been spearheading the world's biggest beach cleanup. All that and more coming up. The river Ganges holds deep religious significance for India's majority Hindu population. In 2017, a court ruled that the Ganges be granted the same rights as humans, with the aim of protecting and cleaning up the polluted waters. But now climate change is also endangering the country's most sacred river. Many fear that one day it could dry up, spelling disaster for the more than 500 million people dependent on its waters. Our reporter Yasvinder Segal travelled to the Ganges to find out more.
I'm in Rishikesh, an Indian town in the foothills of the Himalayas. The sun is setting and hundreds of people have converged on the banks of Ganges. It's more than just a river. To India's 100 million Hindus, it's the embodiment of the great goddess Ganga. The crowds here this evening have gathered to sing hymns in her praise. But worshippers are worried. The mighty Ganges, so central to the religion, culture, and economy of millions of Indians, may one day be reduced to a trickle. Gauri Pandey, age 65, is one of them.
I have been coming here for the last 45 years. I have never seen such little water in the river Ganges. I saw people walking in the river to another bank. The water level was below waist height. Some say that if this trend continues, there's a chance that the Ganges may dry up in the next 30 years.
...53-year-old Chotilal Dubey has run a cobbler's shop on the banks of the Ganges for the last 25 years. He has noticed the changes too.
There's much less water in the Holy River this time. Earlier, there were good rains at high-altitude places like Badrinath, Kedarnath, Gangotri and Yamunotri. But now, they've also dropped. In the coming days, we may see a low Ganges.
The World Wildlife Fund lists the Ganges as one of the world's most endangered rivers. And experts say climate change is the culprit. The river originates in the Himalayas, where it's fed by glaciers. The Gangotri Glacier, more than 5,000 meters above sea level on the Indian side of the snowy Himalayas, provides 70% of the river's water. But India's leading glaciologist, Melapchand Sharma, professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, says it's receding at an alarming rate.
Definitely, the glacier has shrunk by almost 40 kilometers in 50,000 years. But in recent years, we have photographic evidence starting from 1857 onwards. Almost 3 kilometers we have lost until last year. But in recent years, what we feel is that due to the population rise, because of the economic activities and human role, the temperature possibly has gone up. So that has resulted into faster melting. Although we do not know how much, surface thinning is taking place. But the frontal area, yes, from 8 to 22 meters is the rate.
That's worrying. India's 8 states are already all affected by drought. But sinking water levels are not the only problem facing the river, thanks to sewage and agriculture waste. By the time the crystal clear waters have reached the sea at the Bay of Bengal, they have become a filthy soup that's seen the Ganges ranked as the second most polluted river worldwide. That's prompted India's government to invest more than 2.5 billion euros in a national program to clean up the Ganges, which has so far taken precedence over preventing it from drying up. UP Singh heads up the program.
The focus has been basically more on pollution. As far as availability of water is concerned, unfortunately, we haven't worked so much. This is one of our important long-term goals, but more water is flowing in the river Ganges. That perhaps I cannot quantify. Reducing the pollution, which is basically a short-term and medium-term goal of this National Mission for Clean Ganga. But the long-term goal is certainly availability of water.
To achieve that, policymakers have proposed programs that would interlink rivers across different parts of the country, increasing water supply to those that are drying up. But not everyone is convinced by this plan. Rajinder Singh, a winner of the Stockholm Water Prize, also known as the Nobel Prize for Water, is among them.
Interlinking rivers will not make India drought and flood-free, and rather it will create tension and conflicts in the country. Interlinking is a conspiracy which citizens of India should understand. If we wish to free our country from drought and floods, we have to link people with rivers. If we want to save Ganges, we must adapt to climate change by improving greenery. Silting and erosion are the main problems which we need to address. If we revive the small rivers which feed Ganges, the holy Ganges will automatically revive.
In this famous Indian film song, Ram Teri Ganga Maili Ho Gai, they sing, God, your Ganges is shrinking and getting dirty because of continuously washing the sins of people. The Ganges desperately needs to be revived before its waters run dry. Jaswinder Sehgal, DW, Rishikesh, India.
Staying in India, we head south to Mumbai, where every weekend a group of volunteers converges on the city's northern shore to collect rubbish by hand. The team has already collected over 7,000 tonnes of waste over the past 2 years. It's been called the world's biggest beach cleanup, and it all started with one man. Afro Shah was so appalled by the amount of plastic he saw out of his window, he decided to do something about it. In Mumbai, Chavi Sashdev reports.
Most people in Mumbai go to the beach on the weekends to relax. Some run, some come to watch the sunset with their families, couples stroll and take in the sea breeze. But not Afroz Shah. He's on the beach to pick up the trash.
My name is Afroz Shah. I'm a lawyer by profession. I practice as a counsel at Bombay High Court, child of the environment or the nature. That's how I would like to describe myself.
Shah isn't dabbling at being a beachcomber. This is serious business. When he moved to the neighbourhood, he could see over 5 feet of rubbish piled up along the beach. The situation was drastic and it needed what he calls drastic action, which to him translated to rolling up his sleeves for 2 hours every Saturday and every Sunday and picking up trash along 3 kilometres of Versova Beach. Over the last 2 years, he and a rotating team of volunteers have hauled off over 7 million kilograms of trash, and that is no joke.
All volunteers, please start picking up the trash. Kachra utha ke tub mein dalke ek jagah pe collect kijiye.
My beach not only has plastic, it has organic filth. Untreated sewage is being thrown into the sea. So now my plastic at my beach is full of sand, full of muck, full of organic filth. You have plastic straws in them in abundance, single-use plastic. You know, this tobacco-flavored tobacco which people eat, like a detergent powder, small pouches which are made for a rupee. When you litter on a street, you have stormwater drains, coastal cities. Now, the moment you litter, it goes into those stormwater drains. And when the rains happen, or there's an unusual high tide, it sucks everything out and it lands into the ocean. So these littering habits of ours have devastated the marine species and their habitat. They're reeling under it, one. And we have lost our oceans and our beaches to them.
People do want to pitch in to change things. So Shah fixes the cleanup times based on the tides and posts them on social media. The cleanup attracts a real mix of people. Some live close by, residents from fancy beach-facing apartments, others in the slums and the fishing villages of the beach. And then there are students from colleges and schools where Shah has spoken, along with expats, religious groups. Everyone is here. But it started with just him and his 84-year-old neighbor in October 2015.
The first day, I remember, I didn't know actually what kind of gloves to wear to clean it to start with. And then there was one 84-year-old man, Mr. Mathur, who lived in this building. He would come to me to consult about some legal issues this apartment block faced. Before starting on that Sunday, I told him that I'm going to go and clean the beach. Would you like to join? My first invite was to an 84-year-old man.
So your mom was here with you, is that right?
Yeah, the day I went, she was here. And she very amusingly asked me, are you going to clean the beach and the ocean? And now, after almost 2 years, she feels very proud of me being a son and who's working hard for the ocean.
That first day, the two men put on surgical gloves and filled 5 bags of trash. These days, there are at least 150 volunteers for each cleanup, and they fill 2 tractors. At the beach, a few are using rakes to unearth bits of plastic or cloth from the sand. Most people, though, are crouching and pulling out rubbish with their hands. Everyone is wearing gloves. Most people are wearing hats as well. This is the first step. Volunteers fill the trash in colorful tubs, which get emptied into large piles in one area of the beach. These are then picked up by the city workers in tractors and taken to a waste segregation center. What can be recycled is pulled out. The rest, unfortunately, goes to a landfill.
Now, ideally, if you ask me, I don't want to do all this. I want a waste-to-energy plant, a small one which will convert this plastic into... Listening to this, a lot of environmentalists will get horrified what Afroz is saying, because a lot of people don't agree that waste-to-energy plants are great. But for me, I want to have sustainable balance between environment and the conflict between man and environment, with no compromise on environment.
Shah envisions an India where garbage is segregated at source and there's no place for single-use plastics for any kind of packaging. Most people support his endeavor, but a few criticize him too. Some say it's beneath him to do this kind of manual work. Others say he should leave it to the government. It's their job. One person even asked him if he had the government's permission to clean. He says there's no point in passing the buck.
And I tell them I'm not here come to complain. I see a problem, I have taken it on, you come and help me, please, join us. We'll all do together.
Beach cleaning is addictive, Shah says. That's what keeps people coming back.
There is not only a physical adrenaline rush, but there's a sense of well-being in the head of doing something for yourself and the planet.
But I think it's also Shah himself. Even after the cleanup, people gravitate towards him. When I get to his apartment, there are 12 pairs of shoes outside the door. Someone is making tea for the people talking on the couch. Someone is washing their feet in his bathroom. India's multiple faiths, languages, and social strata are represented right here. He says he doesn't have a social life anymore outside of this community. How long will he go on? His answer, for as long as it takes.
I hold the environment in trust for future generation. I'm very clear about it. And when I hold it in trust, I should not cheat on that trust. So we, all of us, every individual, has to hold it in trust.
For DW, I'm Chavi Sachdev, Mumbai. And we're down, we go, go.
Run you down, down.
world's biggest beach cleanup to one of the world's biggest protected marine reserves. In 2017, Chile announced the creation of three new marine protected areas, including one surrounding Easter Island, which is about the same size as the country's total land area. So where does this leave the local fishing industry? Well, some residents of Easter Island have looked to fishing communities in the north of Chile, who were regarded as pioneers in understanding how to adapt and live alongside marine reserves. Jane Chambers met with some of them to find out more.
Desde Rapa Nui, con toda esta buena noticia, le queremos dar un pequeño regalo.
Delegates from Easter Island, or Rapa Nui as the locals call it, are celebrating the announcement of the new marine protected area. They're special guests at a recent international congress on marine protected areas. They're also here to talk to local fishing communities about how they've learned to live with marine reserves. The announcement comes after 5 years of tough negotiations, as one of the delegates, Marcela Hay, explains. She's part of the Rapa Nui marine organisation, Tupu.
We didn't want the government to stop us fishing completely. It's important for us and future generations. So now we've agreed on an area that will have multiple uses, which means we can continue with our ancestral and artisan fishing. Industrial fishing will be banned. We don't want people coming from other regions to use up our resources. We've used the same fishing methods for many years. We fish using stones, but we do have a problem at the moment with overfishing. Tourists are increasing and they like to eat local produce like tuna fish. Now the local fishermen have decided they want to go back to having restricted areas which you can't fish in.
And that's something they're doing at a fishing village called Punta de Choros on Chile's coast. A government group called Senapesca that makes sure industrial and artisan fishermen are complying with Chile's fishing regulations have recently set up an office here. Cristian López is the regional director.
The local specialty here is called locos, or Chilean abalone. They're like giant sea snails. Because of overfishing, they were an endangered species. And so now we have authorized restricted areas and quotas for them, and stocks are up. Divers can get them at certain times of the year. This fishing village, Punta de Choros, is a very good place for them.
Although they found it difficult to live with the restricted areas and fishing quotas at first, communities like Punta de Choros have made peace with the marine reserves. Locals like third-generation fisherman Salvador Varaga are now happy with the regulations and quotas on locos and other seafood. He says that now stocks are up, he can get better prices for his products. He dives for locos once a year, and the rest of the time he takes tourists on tours like this one around the rocky, arid islands in the National Reserve.
Por el tema del pingüino.
At first, we found having the national park and marine reserve difficult. We used to camp on the island and use it as a base for our fishing, but now we aren't allowed to go there because of the penguins. They get stressed when they see humans, and sometimes they used to jump off the cliffs to their death. So no, the islands are out of bounds to us fishermen. It was also hard only being able to fish at certain times of the year, but then we realized that tourism is a good alternative. I'm very happy to work in tourism. The fishermen here started with two boats, and now there are so many tourists. We have 60 boats doing tours around the reserve. We charge $12 per person, and it really helps us now that fishing and diving for seafood is restricted to certain times of the year. I also really love nature. It's great to show people the bottlenose dolphins that live in these waters and the penguins. And I really like some birds called lily cormorants. They are very special. The male mates for life, and if his partner dies, he stays single. But if the male dies, the female will look for a new partner. What do you think about that?
A big topic in fishing communities is how to add value to their products. So fishermen at Punta de Choros built a sea processing plant. It means that they can do everything locally. Dressed in bright white overalls with a net on his hair for hygiene reasons, quality control manager Marco Vasquez explains what they do.
Nosotros trabajamos con jaiba, un cangrejo.
We work with crab. We pre-cook the crab claws here and then freeze them and sell them to places like the United States. Working in an environmentally friendly way is very important to us, so we can take care of our stocks. Because of that, we take off one crab's claw and then release the crab back into the sea because the claw will grow back.
Despite initial concerns, communities here in the Coquimbo region in the north of Chile have made fishing restrictions caused by overfishing and the marine reserves work for them. They've adapted their way of life by doing tourism, adding value to their products and opening restaurants. They say the key is learning to look after their environment. Jane Chambers, DW, Punta de Choros, Chile.
Sustaining fish populations isn't only ecologically important, it's also critical to livelihoods that depend on the fishing industry. Senegal is the third largest producer of octopus on the African continent, but octopus stocks have fallen by 90% compared to the 1980s. For 20 years, unsustainable fishing practices were ignored in the race to make a good profit from feeding the international market. In the fishing village of Joal Fadiot, 60 kilometres south of Dakar, fishermen who witnessed the near-total decline of their livelihood have had no choice but to start fishing responsibly. And their efforts have not been wasted. Our reporter Emmanuel Lande went to see how the octopus is slowly being brought back from the brink.
As a young man, Mamadou Sek feared octopuses. The tentacled creature from the deep evoked fear in him and his friends. They told each other tales of capsized boats and giant sea monsters.
Every time we saw them in the nets, we tried to throw them back. We thought of them as giant squid. You know, like in the tales that showed how an octopus could capsize a boat somehow? When you think of all that, when we saw them in our dugouts, we tried to throw them back. We didn't eat them anyway.
Octopuses have the largest brains of any invertebrates. They're known to be intelligent creatures that can navigate through mazes, solve problems quickly, pull out wires and unscrew jars. An octopus can change colour to disguise itself or will squirt out a thick cloud of black, inky poison into the water to defend itself from predators. Today, in his 50s, the man with the weather-beaten features and a wide smile remembers when he realised octopus might not be the enemy from the sea he initially imagined.
In 1987,
wholesalers began to offer to pay us for our catch, to bring back what we had in our nets so that they could export them. They asked us to bring them to the factory. It's from that moment I realised what octopus was worth.
Once international wholesalers saw the interest in Senegalese octopus abroad, up to 3,000 small fishing boats would head out daily from June to September. Fishermen started catching increasing quantities of the soft-bodied, eight-armed mollusk to make a profit. But 10 years ago, the fishing lines started coming up empty. As it turns out, overfishing caused octopus catch to decrease tenfold, says Dr. Marcel Fall, head of the Oceanic Research Centre, Dakar-Tiaroy.
Historically, octopus fishing started in 1986. That's the year we had a boom and caught 10,000 tons. The year before, we barely had 500 tons. But the record for the biggest catch was in 1999, when we had 50,000 tons. So just imagine, we had 50,000 tons in 1999 to end up with just 4,522 tons. So there is a lot of overfishing. The resource has been overexploited.
Octopus fishing within the coastal area of Joal Fadiot is critical for local fishermen. So the fishing community had to rethink their methods. Today, the local council of artisanal fisheries and the Ministry of Fisheries and Maritime Economy is working to bring octopus stocks back up, starting with the introduction in 1996 of a no-fishing period to let juveniles mature.
It's because of octopus that we introduced the biological rest period in Senegal. It was the first measure in 1996 because of the juvenile octopus production, to have a targeted rest period initiated by the artisanal fishermen.
par des pêcheurs artisans généralement.
Octopuses help maintain the ecosystem by eating enormous quantities of food, but they also provide food for other creatures. Females can lay thousands of eggs, emitting them in long streams into the ocean. Some aquatic creatures feed on these eggs, while others eat the juvenile octopus. Mamadou Thiam is a fish wholesale trader and a member of the Artisanal Fisheries Council. Octopus meat is too valuable to disappear, he says.
Octopus is not eaten in Senegal. All the octopuses caught here are sold in Europe, Italy, Spain, in Japan, and so on. It's more profitable to sell it for export, to make it worthwhile. Almost 900 kilograms of a one-ton catch is sold outside the country.
While some fishermen specialize only in octopus, others will switch to octopus to make the most of the season.
It is a very successful business. Everyone has something to gain from it. It's really a species that has capital importance. As soon as it's octopus season, all the fishermen, the wholesalers come from all over to fish and process octopuses.
Nowadays, up to 1,500 fishing boats head out daily during the octopus season of June to September. As soon as the octopuses come off the boats and into the fish landing centre in Joël Fadjout, they're weighed and categorised by size. More ice is piled on them to keep them fresh and get them ready to be shipped off to Europe and Asia. Wholesaler Thiam says the numbers dropped because octopuses had nowhere to hide to spawn. Octopuses are commonly found near coral reefs where they'll find small crevices and hide under rocks. So in 2004, 25 clay pots were immersed off Joël Fadjout to provide hiding places for octopuses. As part of the octopus management plan, a number of pots are immersed every year. This year, that number rose to 12,000 clay pots. Each one is about a foot long.
The pots last 2 years in the sea, after which they disintegrate to sand. And that's why each year we make new pots.
The pots have helped the octopus population flourish, but nowhere near the amounts fishermen saw in the 80s. Despite the fact females from most species lay thousands of eggs and these young often can mature and reproduce within a year, octopuses can be overfished, leading to smaller catches and smaller octopuses. Senegal is struggling to stay in third position as largest octopus producer in Africa after Morocco and Mauritania. Researcher Fall says quality over quantity needs to be the next priority to secure sustainable fishing practices by increasing the allowed minimal weight for octopuses to 500
grams.
One of the measures we have is the minimum landing weight of 350 grams before gutting. But why not try to match up with what the others do, that's to say Morocco and Mauritania, at 500 grams to avoid exploiting the juveniles, to let them grow. They have a rapid growth anyway, so we'll gain in the long run. We'll gain in the weight, earn much more money, and allow the juveniles to flourish for potential future catch.
Catching fewer but bigger, more valuable octopuses would allow fishermen to maintain their incomes while minimizing exploitation. For DW, Emmanuel Landet in Dakar, Senegal.
And that's all we have time for on this week's show. Our program today was produced with the help of Eliana Giaducci and Jürgen Kuhn. You can listen to Living Planet anytime on iTunes and SoundCloud, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.
We would sing and dance around because we know